I didn't hear what that said.
I think she said it's being recorded.
Can you? Yeah. Mr. Chaffee? My name is Fred. Mr. Chaffee? Fantastic. Can you hear me, Lopez? Aufpassen hier. Komm her, guck. Aufpassen hier.
Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave Kruger. I'm excited about doing this series with you. So welcome to the nuts and bolts of Coaching Money Mastery. You should have two downloads. One is the New Money Story workbook, and the other is the series outline, the seminar outline, so that you don't have to write a bunch of notes. You can just kind of listen and follow along. So if you have those, are accessible from the same place you were directed and got the number to call. So thank you for those of you who have already sent in answers to the couple of questions. If any of you have any responses now, if you haven't sent them in yet or you're just calling in, the two questions that will help me guide and direct some of my discussion and shape some of my response. I have some fundamental notions about what we need to talk about, but I really am interested in the two questions I sent around. If we were to sit down right now, face to face, what's the most important question you have about this topic, about understanding your relationship with your money and your money story and revising or creating a new money story? And after these four seminars, if you walk away saying this was one of the best seminars you've ever attended, what would you walk away with? Would anyone like to respond to that now, if you haven't already? And I appreciate, again, the ones of you who have already responded, and those were some great questions. Anyone? Or anyone just want to check in and indicate what you might like to get out of this series together? Just to give me an
Dave,
idea of where you are. Yes.
This is Wayne Halliday, and I emailed you, an hour ago.
Yeah, those were great.
And
great question. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate
question
it.
Question on my mind.
Yeah. And it was someone else who spoke?
Yes, Dave, this is Mahama from California.
Oh, hey, how are you doing, my man?
I am doing great. Yes, it's been a while. I'm excited.
I didn't even see that you had registered. Were you a late registrant? Did you decide at the gun lamp here?
I guess I saw the email not too long ago, and then I guess went on. I didn't even notice there was a registration link.
Do you have some questions? Thank you for attending.
No, I'm just excited to, learn from you again. That's
well, great,
really
great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Everything going good for you?
Yes, it's beautiful out here. I can't go out much, but it's beautiful through the window.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Super. Who else? Anybody else want to respond to either or both of those questions? Or just say hi?
Hey,
Dave, it's Rob Dillon.
I heard Rob, and I'm coming back to whoever I didn't hear. Go ahead, Rob.
Oh, sorry, excuse me. Hey, Dave, I guess the biggest question I have is just how to change people's long-held belief systems about money. So many people, I think, or they grow up in a family dynamic where they view money a certain way and just had to completely transform their mindset as it comes to money and how they spend it and how much they can make.
You're in the right spot. We're going to do exactly that. The macro system that we're going to look at beginning seminar two is the roadmap, the 7 steps to understand and deconstruct someone's story, to look at the algorithms of what we operate on. Since 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious, it's helpful to know how to understand and deconstruct that in working with clients, in my view. So thank you, Rob. I appreciate that. That's a great question. And someone spoke at the same time as Rob. Would you go now?
Yes, this is Saul. How you doing?
Great. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for asking. So basically,
any questions that you have or things that you're not sure we cover?
Yeah, the gentleman just a minute ago, he pretty much touched on what I was going to go over, but it's pretty much, the actions and practice to really change somebody's money mindset, but also solidify it to where they don't go back to the old ways and the old mindset.
Okay. And here's the secret to that. After all the change and the change of behavior and the strategies and the successful navigation of change, the one key element is the P on the roadmap, the last step, the 7th step of the roadmap, because one of the most powerful forces, if not the most powerful force of the human psyche, is our identity. And we will always go back to our identity, no matter what that is, unless that also has been changed and transformed along with our behavior. And it's the most common reason people revert back to where they were before, because they haven't really evolved and transformed their operating system of how and how they feel. Can I, anytime you call for clear your throat, it's being picked up on the microphone. So let me ask everyone who's not speaking to go on mute, just to preserve our clarity and no distraction. And I'll go on lecture mode in just a moment, so you won't have to worry about that. But that's the primary thing, and that's exactly what we're going to cover, and it's something I think that is really important about applying the mind and brain sciences to strategic coaching. So that's a great question, and we're going to get there, and we're going to get there in a systematic way.
Perfect. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks all. Yeah. Anyone else?
Yes. Hi. I'm Sandra. I'm Sandra Newton from North Carolina, and I do have a question. It's pretty much like the other two gentlemen said, but the other question I was wondering. People who suddenly come into a windfall of money or who have success and now have a lot of money, how to handle that? Because like everyone said, you're raised a certain way and you get a certain thing, and a lot of people lose a lot of money when they suddenly have a windfall of money or get successful.
That's something that I think we don't talk enough about in coaching, is how to deal with extraordinary success, exceptional success. And a very simple example, just to illustrate the very point you're making, in a study of people who won $3 million or more in the lottery, within 5 years, just over 80% had filed bankruptcy. Their money changed, but their mindset didn't. So that's an important question, and we will definitely come back to that, because that does relate to Saul's question. Thank you, Sandra. That's great. Anyone else?
You're welcome.
Hi.
I lost both of you. with one of you to the left. Go first.
Go ahead. Great, thanks. This is Catherine from Colorado. I'm excited to learn from you again. I've taken several of your classes through Coach Training Alliance, and where I got my certification. I'm excited to be back. So I just have a nuts and bolts question, and that is, I am only seeing one handout, and is that it?
There are three things there: the outline, the workbook, and then the reports for the playbook. The outline and workbook are two separate.
Okay.
They're both printable, and I would recommend printing them. Okay.
Right. So the only thing I have access to is something that's 13 pages long.
Yes, me too.
And Dave, I've got access to 100 I think it's 46 pages of workbook, but no seminar outline or anything else.
Okay. Let me get with our IT person and see if you're not seeing the outline and the workbook as two separate downloads. Two separate things to click
on.
I'll take care of that. Thank you. And there was someone also who spoke at the same time. Would you go next?
Hi, this is Catherine from Arizona. I've taken a class, Catherine Zabinski, I've taken a class with you before, Dr. Kruger, and I'm so excited about this.
You can call me Dave.
Okay. All right. I always say Dr. Kruger. All right, Dave. And so I did get the 145-page or something workbook, and there are some questions in that, and then kind of an outline with the different topics with a different date. So, but anyway, so when I coach folks that are going through, I do leadership and career transition, but I also do transition in life in general. So what I'm looking for is to help folks that, to give them tools to build upon, to assist them to move forward, not only about money, but money does hang people up a lot, including me often, not just sometimes. And so I'm going to personally take this class for myself as well, but also to learn how to help people move forward about money issues and life itself, because they're intertwined.
Okay, and thank you for mentioning that, because this is what I would suggest, that each of you do the exercises and work tools in the workbook to get an understanding more in depth of your own story. Now, that roadmap system can be used for any story, money, wellness, career, relationship. We're applying it to a money story here, and I would recommend that you do the corresponding exercises and work tools for each of the seminars that we do, and you'll see in the outline that the particular week will cover a certain aspect of that roadmap system. So those are the exercises and work tools I'd recommend that you do. That's for an optimum effectiveness. Once we understand our own stories and understand ourselves, we're going to be in the best position to help our clients to catalyze their stories and guide what they're doing in the work with us. So great points. Thank you for the energy and enthusiasm. I'm going to move into a lecture mode. I'll reserve a time at the end for questions and a discussion. Also, I'm going to add a 15-minute time if we need that, 10 or 15 minutes after the top of the hour in week four, just to have more of a discussion for anything that you want to reflect on. So jot down the questions you have, the ones that we don't cover now, we'll get to ultimately. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode so you don't need to worry about the background noise. So welcome to Coaching Money Mastery. I'm really grateful for your attendance, for your responses. In the first seminar, we're going to talk about your relationship with money and the power of your money story. The remaining three seminars will look at the principles and practice of systematically understanding and changing that story. So I've integrated information and research in psychology, neuroeconomics, behavioral economics with strategic coaching. So we're about to organize the Mind Matters and Brain Business into the Roadmap System, which is the acronym for the seven-step process to understand your relationship with money and to change your money story. These seven steps deconstruct the process of understanding a story. As I mentioned, whatever story that is, life, wellness, money, and a systematic way of constructing a new or revised one. And those of you who have heard me before will hear some redundancy here. When you are interested in changing a habit or changing a behavior, focus on the system, not just the goal. So we're going to look at an application of your money story, and you'll see that the principles are fundamental to all growth, change, and success. So my mission here is simply to help you examine the way you think, specifically to help you look at and understand your relationship with money and map new possibilities and choices to write a new money story. That way you're going to be in the best position to help your client. Not that you're going to ghostwrite theirs for them, but you have the understanding of the algorithms of how your mind and brain work, the understanding of how to go about creating change in a story. So my hope to guide you to look around the corner at the next years and decades of your life. What you do today can affect the quality and choices, perhaps even longevity, of those tomorrows. And my stretch goal, to have this work together make a positive, powerful difference for you for the rest of your lives. So as I mentioned, as we go through these seminars, I suggest you do the exercises and work tools in the workbook. From Columbia University, we remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. That means we put it in the output channel. That creates a circuitry that's a closure in the brain, a very simple example of that. And this is very recent, from Waterloo, University of Waterloo. Two groups read the same passage. One read the passage silently, the other read the passage out loud. They took a test. The ones that read it out loud did 40% better on the test. So let's first talk about your relationship with money. You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story, though, that you talk about every day, think about several times a day, is remarkably simple, but yet in its own way integrally complex. This story has an internal and an external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. It's complicated because there are some important aspects that are emotional, unspoken, and especially unconscious. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. You may get 10 years out of a car, maybe 40 or 50 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. When I spoke with a well-known internationally known self-help guru, his response was, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell this story to myself in order to know what to change." And that was an elegant simplicity, the most succinct way I've heard it described. You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of a life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play, health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted. At times, you may have used this story to regulate your moods, adjust self-esteem, influence others, try to regulate emotional pains. And I think this is important, how you live this story will be what you teach your children and now your clients and employees. What they see in your behavior and hear or sense as your beliefs will be what they incorporate as their own. They're taking unconscious notes while you're talking about other things. The villain or hero is the most popular legal substance to all people of the world. It speaks to you and you speak with it. Of course, it's your money story. Lauren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers. So let's consider two questions. Write down your immediate first word answer to both of these. What does money mean to you? One word. Actually, it's three questions. Number two, right now, and this is confidential, nobody's going to see it, and you can cover it over your left hand in case somebody walks by if you're right-handed. What is your current annual income? Just one figure. Number three, what would your current annual income need to be in order for you to be happy, carefree, feel fulfilled, and have no worry or stress about money? Write down that figure. Okay, we'll come back to that. Let's consider two questions. What's your money story? Now, your money story is not your income, expenses, assets, debt, net worth. It's your relationship with money. The plot and storylines of your money autobiography. It's the unconscious tale you tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. It's a running dialogue about how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you think you're capable of. And it's also about what would happen if you had more or less. One way to think about it is we speak with money. We speak in one way, in a straightforward way. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. It can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, but also what we fear and lack, for what we covet, crave, spurn, chase, follow. We use money to show how much we care or how little. We may use it to measure success or try to buy happiness, to regulate moods, to influence others. In other words, we use money to communicate. We also speak with money as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value. We have a relationship with it, even though we may not think about it in that way. We use money to do many things and speak for us and speak with it. We also use it as a self-statement. Money can make any statement. what people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say is about yourself. And a life story and a money story manifest through self-statement. And the story always tells most about the teller. Here are some of the statements that you'll see made with money. A proclamation of freedom. A currency of caring. A promissory note of happiness. The embodiment of power. Evidence of security. Proof of worth. License for opportunity. Instrument of control. You see a new car and you want it. But what you're really doing is playing out your money story, because just below consciousness, there's a new plot line. This car is going to show what I'm worth. This is going to make people respect me. This is going to validate me. You know, think about how, for those of you who do couples coaching, you meet with a couple and one of their issues, often a major one, is about money. You see very quickly that one of the two partners' brain is wired that money equals freedom. The other partner's brain is wired that money equals security. So for freedom, it means being able to enjoy and spend freely, and for security, it means saving and having for a rainy day. So you have your work cut out for you to look at navigating a collaborative agreement about how both needs and meanings can be met in a way that's going to be mutually satisfying. An obvious example is a self-statement of spending money. Conspicuous consumption. You buy a red BMW convertible and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption. You buy a red BMW convertible in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, that's not a self-statement. I would never buy a red BMW. Without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves in our lives. For example, in self-talk. Not all of this may be conscious. Remember, 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. We see the results. We'll come back to that. Examples of internal beliefs. People who have significant money are lucky. People with money are different from me. You have to work really hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money will probably buy happiness. Money means the same to everyone. We use money in an external dialogue. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create unusual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. We can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not someone's age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, after we can do these things again, how much money do you make? And you won't see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? And you may not see dessert. Here's a true story from a number of years ago. An agent at a writer's conference discussed working with her author. This is an internationally known agent. I looked forward to attending her conference because I'd heard about her and knew some of her clients. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations and many aspects of working with an agent and how to optimize that. Finally, as we were getting close to the end, somebody, and this was not me, by the way, asked, would you talk about how much money is involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? Because she had totally avoided that. She looked kind of shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt that you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself. Another person in the back row, also not me, said, I thought once you finished the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course he was right. The frankness and confrontation of both of these people sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. And it was immensely valuable to most of the people in the audience who were writing books for a living. So the speaker finally revealed the specific figures involved and led a discussion that was immensely useful. Another, an internal dialogue. We may not speak openly of something, but our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, which is really our time and energy, for something else. Every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, often silent and automatic, has many dialects. Let me give you a couple of examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row, this can tell you how long ago it was, chopping cotton for my dad on the farm and ranch in hot summer days. When I saw school started, I saw my classmates right after lunch have a soda and a candy. I joined them. And very quickly, my treats were gone, and I immediately thought, was that candy worth half a row of cotton chopping? Was that Coke worth an entire row? And in a good day, I would make 80 cents in the morning. I very quickly answered no to both questions. That also is emphasized in a blog I did about the cost of money. We talk about the value of money. We may help our kids, you know, with a clothes allowance and collaborate with them about whether to buy, you know, the horse and the pony or two alligators. You know, but the cost of money is something that we need to think about. And I'm going to return to this because there's some very real considerations about that that can make a difference, I think, for your clients without them even realizing the kind of decisions they're making. Other examples, at an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. The preamble of spending may be to rationalize. Well, this seems like a lot of money to spend on an HD big screen TV, but if I amortize it over the next 11 years, it's only 27 cents a day. Rationalize spending. We regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money, probably spent without much debate. Salary or professional fee money, serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement, only with definite need or emergency. This is a framing bias. It's the same dollar, and it's treated differently based on the context. From a recent documentary, a woman on the verge of declaring her fourth bankruptcy said, the high from shopping is more powerful than the low from bankruptcy. And she was into brain science there, although it was driving her, and we'll return to that. Or, finally, the parent who says, well, I spend so much time at work, when I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it, a kind of a justification bias. A compromise occurs when two money stories are written simultaneously. The surface story, and that's usually the conscious story. Remember, that's only 5 or 10%. I want to make significant money and accumulate wealth. The shadow story, and it may well be unconscious, written by that 90% or more of the operating system that's unconscious, comes along with a different storyline that can actually go in the opposite direction, whether or not you're fully aware of it or not. Well, I don't think I have what it takes, or making a lot of money is unspiritual, or, you know, I realize that if I go all in and then don't make it, I'll be hugely embarrassed and ashamed. So listen for the surface story, and if there's a shadow story that may even go in the opposite direction, creating a stuckness by someone. Here's an example of a dual story of conflict not applied to money. The surface story, I want to claim my freedom and become my own person, my own authority. The shadow story is, well, I can't have total authority because my partner acts like I'm taking it away if I do. So let's think about now how money speaks to us. And you may be familiar with this study. It was done some time ago, but it's still intriguing. A study was done in which volunteers had their brain scanned using fMRI scans when they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon. Now, I have some elaborate mechanisms to get research from around the world, correspond with a couple of neuroeconomics, but I have never found studies like this to volunteer for, where you get free wine. The volunteers were told before tasting the price of each of the wines. So they knew the price. They rated the wines, and as you might expect, according to price, the most expensive one, they rated the highest, the best, on down to the least expensive as the least desirable. And their brains corresponded. The area of their brains that encode the pleasantness of an experience, the medial orbital frontal cortex, was more active with the most expensive wine and sequentially down, exactly matching their rating. Actually, the volunteers tasted one wine with 5 different stories. They experienced more pleasure and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. Money sometimes communicates to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. Money can speak to us as a confidant, a seducer, an adversary, a protector, a drug. Money serves as a tangible container for things like hope, freedom, ambition, love, or disappointment. Money is the one true metaphor that can stand for anything else. Now, let's go back to that quiz that you did. The one word meaning of what money means to you. Well, as you might guess from money equations, and we talked about money can make any statement. Worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. Those are some of the more common ones. You may have had some unique ones. But I'll bet one of those is not too far off from what you did. Now, let's look at the other. And I've done this survey with several hundred people beginning a number of years ago when the first book I did about money came out. And this was, it was a little skewed because it was upper middle class and upper class people. So that's a caveat here. But for the look at your figure for what your current annual income is, and then look at the figure for what your current annual income would need to be carefree and worry-free about money. And over 90% of the people, the figure is double, just about double. Now, the interesting thing is that in follow-up studies, that there's a trailing double. In other words, people who made $100,000 at the time and thought it would take about $200,000 to be happy and worry-free, when they got to $200,000, they thought it would take $400,000. So that's one thing to consider, and the thing that we address every coaching session is to create a map where someone is, where they want to be, the goal, to measure progress along the way, to tell what's detour and distraction. That says, do you have a map about your money? Because more and perfect are not goals. So, and this is how I first came to be aware of money stories with people, is working with a number of people in psychoanalysis back in the day, when people who were remarkably successful would come in, and they recognized that they had done this kind of putting it off into the future to say, I'm really going to be happy when, you know, I'm worth $5 million, or when I have everything paid off, or, you know, they had something in mind. And when they were fortunate enough to get there, they, after, you know, a couple of times of reaching it, they realized that that really wasn't the answer that they had hoped for. So that led them to consult with me to see if there was something else that could be addressed. So, a secret language becomes more developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs show up as symbolic wants. And a desire is not quieted by its satisfaction. And desires can actually be created by filling them. And money, of course, is the legal tender of desires. Money is the ink blot of the Rorschach test. When we look straight at it, there's a design on paper. But if we have the chance, and we will, whether anybody asks us to or not, and we will because that's how our minds and brains work, we imbue that design, that dollar bill, with meaning. And the interpretations will be as wishful and varied as the fantasies of the respondents. It is a true Rorschach. People may think money is a reflection of herself, of their self-worth. Are there morals? One woman said, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I shouldn't have money problems. Well, money isn't related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps your money. Are there ethics? President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Now, we know that. That's not true. You may work hard, but overspend, gamble, have five kids, three of whom are college age, live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction. So here's another question. Who do you think in America has the best work ethic? Look at a spectrum of possibilities. You know, ethnic, economic, cultural, jobs. Who in America do you think has the best work ethic? Here's the answer. Heroin addicts. They get up every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week, including holidays, 365 days a year. They cannot let a single day go by without working. And it's not because their self-esteem will suffer. One heroin addict summarized it by saying, if I don't get up early tomorrow morning and hustle all day, the next day I'll die. So I say that to not confuse work ethic with performance ethic, and especially success ethic. So why do we make these money errors? The more we give money meaning, the more we may lose focus on the simplicity of what money really is as a simple medium of exchange. And then we do strange things with money. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. Two of my clients have been Madoff victims. Their entire fortune was decimated by Madoff. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Let me say that again. You heard me right. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Gifted people may not convert their talent into sufficient income. Balanced individuals spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Otherwise dependable people ignore financial matters until they're serious. Highly principled individuals step over boundaries or write their own rules. Others are taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, CEO of CyberNet, conned investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. Burton listened to his mama. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories until they're listened to and strategically changed. And money's become more abstract. The vast majority of our money handling does not occur with passing currency. Here's a 22-second history of money. First, a couple of goats were exchanged for five bags of rice. Then, coins enter as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange. Coins are replaced by paper bills. Then, paper checks. Then, plastic. Then, a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money becomes more abstracted, transactions are easier, but our understanding of money fades, and our relationship with it changes. A really simple example, and this is an extensive study. When people use credit cards, they spend 23% more than when they use cash or write checks. So, what's the role of the mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? Why have I been telling you all this stuff, and why is this a preface for the work we're going to do? Two questions. Well, the answer is everything. So, two questions here. Why do we resist change? Even changing a story that doesn't work. This alludes to the comments a couple of you ask about. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result, even when it leads maybe to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships, even when they know the right thing to do? And some of you have heard me say before, if information were enough, we'd all be thin, we'd have a lot of money saved up for the future, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd work out every day, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. But information is not enough. Nassim Taleb asks in The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user manual. So part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's our default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. We leave our comfort zone. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story, even though it may not work as well. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of identity, the internal map that's synonymous with a core identity of self. We tend to return to our default mode because that immediately ends the anxiety. Let's do a brief exercise. If you can, I hope you have a headset, but or a speakerphone. Put your palms together right in front of you and interlock your fingers and thumbs very firmly. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, firmly clasping, but change the position only of your thumbs. One's on top, put it on bottom, vice versa. Now, how does that feel? A little bit awkward? Now, put it back to the original position. That's kind of the way things ought to be. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Every conversation you have with every client, this is the unspoken push and pull. Now, the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. That was our minds. This is our brains now. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags, indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn, despite it being very circuitous. He did that with increasing turns and diabolical twists. Not a single person ever started a new, more direct route. No matter how many turns and twists, each person followed the path of least resistance. That's how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. So, to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. That's what we do, as you think about it, in coaching. We break the script. We may do that in a simple way by converting a period into a comma and say, well, tell me more, or let's look at how that's working, or let's go further with that. Or simply to story bust. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, new context, or simply a question that refocuses the energy field of the client's brain. Now, we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as evidence not to proceed. In other words, the client experiences doing something new as a discomfort. Now, if they read that discomfort as, well, this is my intuition telling me it's the wrong thing, or I have a gut feeling that I'm not doing the right thing, this is where we come in as coaches to help them reframe this, to look at it as an understandable experience of discomfort, our empathic resonance, and to reframe it as a signpost of change and progress. Every step into new territory is going to be an experience of not quite knowing a minor to a major discomfort. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located very close to the emotional center of the brain that says, this isn't normal when we try something new. And we'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. In a simple way of saying it, we struggle to embrace change. We may want to change, but we struggle to embrace change. Here's something to keep in mind. When your client is resistant, or when you feel frustrated that they are not changing or reverting back, remember that any belief, any habit, any fact is an anatomical reality in their brains. And you can't just simply create a new fact or a better way of doing things and think that it's going to instantly overwrite what's already there, because that's a well-grooved habit. Whenever someone, like when you drive the same way to work every day, basically, after you do that a month or 6 weeks, you don't have to think about it anymore, because that's the exact major aspect of how our brain functions, is to hardwire behavior that's repeated. It's been evolutionary, in an evolutionary sense, highly significant. So the way to do it, the way to drive, is hardwired. So that means you can listen to an audiobook or have a conversation. You don't have to think about it. But if there's maybe construction, you have to snake your way through neighborhood, it takes energy. And you'd rather not do it. It's a little bit annoying, but you can't quite listen to the book with the same attention that you did before. So we struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how our mind and brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. So we're going to be wrapping that into our discussion, because that's something that every aspect of moving forward means relinquishing a past position. We're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different areas to understand resistance to change and guide strategies of change. We even have to outsmart our brains at times. We can reprogram our minds and rewire our brains to create wealth and success. So, how do we get our brains to work with us in creating money stories? Well, the brain, in a way, has a mind of its own, and we are of two or more minds. Neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, as I've mentioned, a video of the brain in action as it responds to different situations. Now, these studies have disproven the long-standing assumption that people have a consistent and predictable set of preferences and responses that they choose based on logic. The whole discipline of behavioral economics says this isn't so, and there's a study of how it isn't so in that whole arena. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways. Money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activity. So we're going to use these findings to inform certain decisions. Here's a glimpse of some examples. The prefrontal cortex says, well, let's think about the 12-month game plan and retirement savings. But the limbic system says, ah, relax, man, have a single malt and order that 27-inch iMac. My amygdala even specifies the brand of single malt. Each part of the brain struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without carrying it. Emotions can corrupt decision-making, but they also help to narrow attention and compress focus on the immediate. And people who feel no emotion are not good at decision-making. Making people happy is not simply giving them more of what they prefer. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects it to continue. So this is what Kahneman talked about as the hedonic treadmill. It takes more and more to have the same kind of pleasure or satisfaction with something. David Geffen said, anybody who believes that money makes you happy doesn't have money. When someone's stock portfolio does well, they may infer that it's due to talent, smartness, and it may be. But here's another simple example. Gamblers interpret good fortune as skill. My wife and I play heads-up poker, and she finally confessed that one of my tells is when I happen to draw a lucky hand, I have a slightly smug look that it looks like I think I'm brilliant. So these are some things to think about as you're doing the creating a mindset and asking some questions about a money story. So I want to reserve a few minutes to look at questions. We're going to be talking about each of the steps in the roadmap beginning next seminar. Hold on one second. Okay, we're in a discussion mode now. Questions, if you'll manage the background noise and go off mute when you're ready. Any thoughts, questions, or comments that you have, or clarifications about anything that we talked about? Thank you for managing the background noise. It sounds really good. Every time you move paper, if you're not on mute, it's gonna pick it up. So get off mute only when you're ready to talk, if you would. So
Dave, this is Wayne.
Yeah, please.
I know that my father did a very good job of teaching me that people with money were crooked or got it by bad means.
Yeah.
That whatever I did was not good enough, and that somehow out of that I got that I don't deserve money. Now, I'm consciously aware of all this. I've discussed it with my wife, who's very perceptive. But, you know, I'll be damned if I can get past it.
Well, when you want to change, look at a system. So it's not just, you know, what, and I'm going to kind of look at what you just said in a very simple way. What you did, what you described is booting up a software program on your desktop and talking to it and hoping it's going to change. You have to look at the algorithms. You have to look at changing the elements that comprise the story. And that's exactly what we're going to do. So that's a great preface question for the next three seminars. So your check is in the mail. It was a perfect question because that's exactly the dilemma that your clients are going to experience. They may not even know to ask that question. They may just be trying to make their story right. You know, to know to ask is half the answer. So you're already halfway there. in a recent, again, there's, I'm still hearing some paper shuffling, background noise, if you go on mute until you're ready to talk. And I want to emphasize that by saying there are a couple of studies in a recent Harvard Business Review and Scientific American Mind that show that the premier quality that creates success in executives is self-awareness and self-reflection of regulation, self-awareness and self-regulation. Now, that study is applicable to every, they only studied executives, but that, in my view, is applicable to everyone. The most important thing that we can do with our clients is to first help them regulate a state of mind, because that helps them access the software that's going to help them optimally perform or address the issues that they want to deal with. So it's like finding the right software, getting regulated and grounded first so that they have access to all of the different programs and all of their states of mind. If you haven't done this already, I think this would be a useful backdrop to what we're talking about. There is a free webinar on the homepage of MentorPath. Whenever you go to www.mentorpath.com, front and center is a webinar on master states of mind. So I'm not going to say anything else, hoping that you'll go there and look at that. There's also an outline to download there, and it's free. I think it's a good backdrop to so much of what we'll discuss, and I think it's probably the most important thing that we can do with and for our clients is to help them regulate states of mind. So thanks for that question, Wayne. Other comments, so we'll get there.
My comment, David, this is Bonita in Baltimore,
okay,
Maryland.
How you doing?
I'm exceptional, thank you.
Okay.
So happy to be here.
Great. Me too, you.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed the session very much, and I think that what came to my mind on a very personal level is as money has come in, that it's not an apathy about the money. It's being aware of decision-making about money. A quick example, I went with the stock market right now, trading options. I'm training myself to do that. And in doing so, I had set a certain amount of money I put aside. I said, I will use this amount of money, and I won't go any further. If I lose down, then I'll stop. And that's exactly what I did. I'm not a gambler. But I did notice that there was a lack of concern about, well, if I lose that, that's fine, because I made that decision. But I also walked away saying, Bonita, why is it that you do have any concern about losing that at all? Why have you flipped to the other side now, where I want to gain more insight of the decisions that I made? Do you understand my question, if I'm making sense?
May I coach you for a moment?
Please do so.
Okay. And this is what I would do with developing it a bit more, but because of time, I'm going to compress it. There are two things that you said that I would like you to examine. When you first said, when money is coming in, that's
mm-hmm.
a passive statement. That does
mm-hmm.
not take full ownership of you authoring your story of you are earning or generating money. Money's not coming in. You're earning it. You didn't inherit it. It didn't just come in. So when you take ownership, you're going to take more responsibility of the choice architecture of every aspect of a decision that you make. So the other thing is, at the very instant you moved from talking in first person, you said I, and then at one instant you said you when you began that self-talk. And it was not negative self-talk, but whenever you moved to you, you moved from the heart of your experience to an observer's platform and referred to yourself in the second person. There's something about that instant that you changed that needs to be, from I to you, that needs to be examined, because there's something that's generating a bit of discomfort or disavowal about that. Now, does that make sense the way I said it and compressed it?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Because, I thank you so much for saying that, because this is just a couple of examples of how we can listen to how someone constructs their story and learn together a good deal about that. This would not be just, if we were truly working together, just a highlight or an announcement. It would be an exploration of looking at that, understanding it, and how to construct a different story that is more proactive and looking at things in a very different way. So I know you know a lot about this material, so I think you can do. Would you give us a progress note, Benita? Would you feel comfortable giving us just a 30-second or a 1-minute progress note at the beginning of next seminar about what work you've done on this?
Yes.
I think it can be of real benefit to people to hear how this can actively be dealt with and how you can really use something like this, and even in the slight ways. It's a great illustration of you know, working with people. So I really appreciate you saying that. Now, I know we're out of time. We're even a minute or so over. Those of you who haven't sent in answers to the question, I welcome them. Jot down any questions. We'll have a discussion at the beginning of our next seminar, at the beginning and end. Thank you all very much. I appreciate all of your energy and responsiveness, and it's a real privilege to do this. I love doing this, so I look forward to picking up right here next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
See you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Have a great week.
See you guys.
Have a good one.
I'm going to really fight for this one. I'm going to fight to participate. This is awesome. Thank you. Okay.